Across the country, cities and states are grappling with removing symbols of the American Confederacy and other markers of the United States' dark history of oppression. But in Alabama, change is happening more slowly. On June 1st, Alabama observed a state holiday celebrating the birthday of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy. It's one of three holidays celebrating the Confederacy in Alabama. Over the weekend, former U.S. Attorney General and current Senate candidate Jeff Sessions said a proposal to remove names of the Confederacy soldiers from U.S. military bases would, quote, betray the character and decency of those who fought to continue Southern slavery. But last week, Congresswoman Terry Sewell, the lone Democrat representing Alabama in Congress, took to social media to say it's time to stop celebrating the Confederacy. Sewell wrote, quote, we need atonement to heal. Sewell represents the 7th Congressional District of Alabama, which includes Selma, Birmingham, and Montgomery, which were key sites of the civil rights movement. And Representative Sewell joined me last week to talk about this moment, just as her state is also seeing a sharp uptick in coronavirus cases.
You know, I think that over the last few months, of course, I think we have to start by just saying COVID-19 has had a disproportionate effect on my constituents. I proudly represent my home district, which includes Birmingham, Montgomery, and my hometown of Selma, Alabama. The effects of COVID-19 were devastating enough, being that so many of my constituents are disproportionately affected as African Americans and at risk. And now, on top of the global health pandemic, we're in the middle of another pandemic. And as my constituents ask me often, and friends have been reaching out and asking me, how do I feel? You know, I have to say, I'm not doing well. It's very complicated, right? I think that I'm not okay. I'm not okay as I witness a reopening of Alabama's economy on Memorial Day and sights of folks at the beaches without masks on, and a huge spike in our number of hospital beds, ICU beds. It's really frightening, and a huge spike in the number of cases. It's pretty frightening. And then, of course, I have to say, my emotions swing from frustration and anger to real jubilance to see another generation of Americans doing what our democracy allows us to do, and that's to grieve send our grievances and redress to our government and expect change. Protest is the highest form of civic engagement. And I just hope that during this moment, we who are in positions of power are listening and that we are willing to change.
We are seeing protests starting to move the needle on certain issues, particularly when it comes to the main thrust of these protests, which is police brutality. And we are seeing some change at the policy level. How is the state of Alabama managing the protests? Are there limits on protesting in certain parts of the state? What's the police presence been like so far?
You know, it's really interesting because given the fight for political power that really took place on the grounds of, in the sites and places of my district, Alabama, Birmingham, Montgomery, Selma, we currently have African-American mayors of the city of Birmingham and the city of Montgomery. And, you know, the protests for the most part have been quite peaceful. We did have an incident that required the African-American mayor of Birmingham to institute curfew, as did across the state. Others instituted curfews. And so, but since then, that was about 7 days ago, all the protests have been pretty peaceful. And the reality is that we're seeing generations, it's intergenerational. You're seeing young and old, and you're seeing black and white, and it's a rainbow coalition of a tapestry that's beautifully reflective of the American diversity. And, you know, you're seeing protest in suburbs of Alabama, like Mountain Brook, with 300, you know, white kids, young and old, protesting. And so I think that we are at an inflection point, and you hear that a lot, but I do believe that this moment is different. The angst and the pains of watching another unarmed black man who is handcuffed with someone's knee to his neck just has in really inflamed the emotions and caught and ignited the emotions of the world. And I think now is the time for us to change. And I truly hope, as a member of Congress, you know, all of us have a role to play. Our role is to see what we can do in the federal realm to change laws. And I get that laws don't necessarily change hearts, but it can change someone's mind if it's illegal to have a chokehold, or if no-knock warrants are banned, that people will think twice because these are illegal measures. So I just think that we are at a critical point, and I just pray that we come together, Republicans and Democrats, and truly hear and see the cries of America that change is afoot when it comes to police accountability.
We're talking about police accountability. As I mentioned, and I'm sure as you know, we're already seeing change at the local level. At the federal level, however, there is the Justice and Policing Act of 2020. You are one of the many co-sponsors of that act. Tell us the crux of what this act is intended to do from a federal level, and what is it supposed to fix?
It seeks to hold the police accountable by making sure that we work to end racial and religious profiling. It prohibits state, federal, and local law enforcement from racial profiling. It saves lives by banning chokeholds and no-knock warrants. Our realm is within federal law, but by leading by example in the federal government, by making sure that that our federal funding will be conditioned upon states and local governments banning chokeholds and banning no-knock entry or warrants that are required. It also would limit military equipment on American streets and require body cameras. It will hold police accountable in the court system by making sure that we change the standard that's required from one of willfulness to recklessness when it comes to prosecuting officers for federal criminal statutes to prosecute misconduct by the police. It will also provide a registry so that we actually can collect the data to know who are the bad actors and make sure that we are creating a nationwide police misconduct registry to prevent problematic officers who are fired or leave one jurisdiction from moving from jurisdiction to jurisdiction without accountability. It mandates state and local government law enforcement agencies to report the use of force data and disaggregate it by race and sex and disability, age, and religion. It also would make lynching a federal crime. It's also about empowering our communities. I was very happy that we worked so hard to put in the bill grants to communities to support critical community-based programs that will change will seek to change the culture of law enforcement and empower communities to reimagine public safety in an equitable and just way.
Congresswoman, I want to ask you, because this is a really comprehensive list of things that activists in particular and criminal justice reform activists and advocates have been asking for quite some time. All of the things you listed are basically a checklist of how from the activist perspective, at least, to reform and improve policing. Curious about whether this is, given the moment and given the checklist that you just described, is there bipartisan support for this? And are there any other things that, in order to get bipartisan support, will have to be left out of the bill going forward?
So we're seeking bipartisan support. I believe that the cries of the American people on the streets all across this nation, from big cities to small towns, people are crying out for transformational change in our policing. And this bill, Justice and Policing, does that. And while we have over 200 sponsors right now, and they're all Democrats, I am encouraged by the fact that I hear senators, Republican senators, talk about banning chokeholds, banning no warrant entries, and I do believe that that they all see the need that we have common ground, that we can find some common ground in legislation to move the needle forward. I even see hope and in Republicans thinking about doing away with qualified immunity, immunity, which is really important as well. So I think that what's going to have to happen is that we're day 18 of protests in the streets, and they're not abating, right? We're seeing more and more people feel galvanized and empowered. And this is what democracy looks like. Democracy, power demands, you know, power is concedes nothing without a demand. And what we see on the streets of America right now is it was true in 1850 when Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand, never has, never will. And it's true today. And what they're demanding is change. And I do believe that we will find some bipartisan common ground. I believe that the Justice in Policing Act is that common ground. As you rightfully said, this has included a checklist of what criminal justice activists, law enforcement groups have been demanding for the longest. You know, it's true that the majority of law enforcement officers are good, but good cops and good sheriffs want accountability, welcome accountability and transparency. And so I think that we have got to find common ground. As I was saying to my niece, who told me that it's her generation's turn to be heard. They want us to not only see them, but to hear them. And I told her, I'm listening, but it's all about action. We want to make sure that the righteous indignation and anger that we're seeing on the streets of America bore out positive change. Otherwise, I'm so afraid that we'll lose a whole generation of activists who need to see that civic engagement, protesting, voting matters, and that we are hearing them and that we're doing something about it.
You mentioned earlier when we talked about those protests in Alabama, how they are reflective of a new moment in this society, particularly when it comes to who's participating. So there's a multiracial coalition. You called it the Rainbow Coalition. I recall that Jesse Jackson talking about that vision back in the 1980s. And it feels like, you know, we're steps closer to that, at least in terms of who's on the ground. And yet these protests are happening, Congresswoman, with the backdrop, at least in Alabama, of days, holidays that celebrate people like Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee. How does Alabama right now reconcile celebrating Jefferson Davis, celebrating Robert E. Lee with public holidays, and this moment where people are calling for change, not just at the very top, but also in the very symbols that we see around us every day?
You're absolutely right. You can't say, do you see me? And then have these symbols, and there are over 1,000 Confederate symbols across this nation. And the state of Alabama, as you said, I've called for them to stop celebrating as a state holiday Jefferson Davis's birthday, Robert E. Lee's birthday, veterans of the Confederacy. Those are three holidays. I mean, it's a no-brainer. What you see on the streets of America are people crying out to be seen. And if you see me, then you cannot continue to have these paying honor and homage to oppressors, people who oppressed me and people who look like me. You know, in Alabama, we saw a mayor in the city of Birmingham take down a monument. We saw a white mayor in Mobile take down a monument. And yet the attorney general of the state of Alabama, because we have a law on the books that you can't take down the Confederate monuments without the approval of the state legislature, the onus is really going to be on the state of Alabama to literally, at this moment in history, live up to the creed of justice for all and do the right thing. The very least to me is to see me and to acknowledge my pain and to take down these monuments and to do away with these holidays. There are people who claim that these monuments honor history and Southern culture, but we have to be clear-eyed about why these monuments and holidays are so horrific to African Americans. Historically, these monuments saw spikes of activity from the 1890s to the 1920s when civil rights leaders were fighting for long-delayed justice for African Americans, and still they persist and the laws still protect them. And I think now, these are low-hanging fruit. This is a no-brainer, in my opinion. Will it change things when it comes to systemic racism? No, but it is the start of a conversation. It is an acknowledgement that, in fact, you do hear me, you do see me and you do hear my pain.
Congresswoman, you mentioned systemic racism, and it's something that I, frankly, I'm surprised that that phrase is being used by so many people, both in the media, who may never have experienced or really understood systemic racism. One of the ways, as you know, that systemic racism plays out is at the polls, is when in voter suppression. And Alabama has had its own history with voter suppression and concerns about where that is playing out. We know, and we've been discussing on this show, that there's a big issue in Georgia. What are some of the issues that Alabama is afraid of right now when it comes to making sure, or concerned about, I should say, when it comes to making sure that residents of Alabama, black, white, poor, rich, will all be able to cast a ballot come November?
Yes, I think that what we witnessed this past Tuesday in the states that were holding primaries, especially in Georgia, with long lines, is just, to me, emblematic of the fact that we do need to fully restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965. You know, I not only represent Selma, I am a daughter of Selma. I am a lifetime member of Brown Chapel AME Church, where Martin Luther King led the protests in 1965 for the right to vote. And what we saw in Georgia is a direct reflection of the fact that the Shelby versus Holder gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965. We saw long lines. We saw polling stations that were closed because ostensibly for COVID-19. But we also saw inexperienced poll workers there. And we have got to do something right now to make sure that we're protecting the constitutional right for every American to be able to vote. Long lines wrapped around the corner, polling stations not being able to open on time because of new machinery. It's inexcusable. These are modern day barriers to voting. You may not have to count how many marbles are in a jar anymore, but when you have, you know, systematic efforts to make it harder to vote, these are modern day barriers, be it long lines at the polls, be it photo ID laws that prefer gun registration IDs as a form of a legitimate form of a photo ID, your fishing license or your gun license, and not your student license at the University of Alabama. Unacceptable. And so we really need to push back. And I do believe that what you see on the streets of America right now is truly, the call to action was the death of George Floyd. But we know that we've seen this happen time and time again. We need to focus on policing and police accountability, which was the impetus for the protests. Systemic racism is ultimately the root, and it is seen in everything we do, from housing to education to the criminal justice system. It means that in America, we have never really reckoned with 400 years of slavery. And there's a wonderful museum that Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative did in Alabama. And it's about reconciliation. It's lynching, but it's really about America coming to grips with its own racism that really permeates every part of our society. That's what systemic racism is. It's structural institutional racism that exists in America. And to say that one is colorblind is really a myth.
And to sort of close here, I mean, one of the things that I think, you know, we're discussing racism and systemic racism and police reform, and yet, the media has almost taken its eye off a little bit of the back and forth in Washington, right, between the Democrats and Republicans. This is one of the most divided houses and divided governments I think most of us have seen in our lifetime. When we look at Alabama, Congresswoman, what is the future of the Democratic Party in Alabama? You are the only Democrat representing the state in the U.S. House. So where does the Democratic Party go from here in Alabama?
Well, listen, I think that for all of my state's faults, I do believe that it is a state that is filled with people of goodwill who really do want to try to do the right thing. And while I may be the only member of the House of Representatives, the fact that we were able to elect Doug Jones to the United States Senate from the state of Alabama, and we did so electing a Democrat in a state where the Alabama Democratic Party has really been diminishing over the years. I'm excited about our new state chair. We have Chris England, State Representative Chris England is the first African-American to actually be ahead of the state party in the state of Alabama. He's doing an incredible job in bringing a whole new generation of Alabamians, black and white, people of color, a true tapestry rainbow coalition into the Alabama Democratic Party. And I am hopeful. I have to be hopeful. I want to be the change that I want to see in my state and in my nation. And collectively, this is our watch. I get that I am a member of Congress, but all of us are seeing this and all of us have a role to play. And I just really, I really ask your listening audience, we have to all just reflect and decide, how can we make a difference? It's one thing to ask your black friends how they're doing, but the reality is, this is collectively all of our watch and we all have a role to play. What are we willing to do to see a better America, to see an America that truly is inclusive? Inequities in race exist in every part of our society. And so we all have a part to do in order to make this this nation a more perfect union.
Congresswoman Terry Sewell represents the 7th Congressional District of Alabama. Representative Sewell, thank you for your time.
Thank you.